The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Section. The Democratic Party and the Limits of Reformism in the United States. Illusions in the Democratic Party as a party of the people have been the great Achilles heel of the left in the United States. Throughout much of the country's history, the Democratic Party has positioned itself as a popular alternative to the more conservative, blatantly pro-capitalist Republican Party. Both parties, however, are intimately tied and committed to capitalism. Part of the reason that the U.S.'s survival of the fittest periods of economic restructuring are so relentless rests on the performance of the Democrats as history's second most enthusiastic capitalist party, writes former right-wing pundit Kevin Phillips. Quote, they do not interfere much with capitalism's momentum, but wait for the excesses and the inevitable populist reaction. End quote. The two-party system has been tremendously successful in preventing the emergence of any successful third-party challenges, from the left or the right. As far back as 1893, Engels astutely observed that the formation of a workers' party in the United States was hindered by a, quote, constitution, which makes it appear as though every vote were lost that is cast for a candidate not put up by one of the two governing parties. End quote. His description of the U.S. political system as consisting of, quote, two great gangs of speculators who alternately take possession of the state power and exploit it by the most corrupt means and for the most corrupt ends, end quote, reads like it was written yesterday. Both parties have always been funded by big business. Both are supporters of overseas conquests, and both have used troops to quell strikes. Before the Civil Rights Movement, moreover, the Democratic Party was the party of Jim Crow segregation. In his Socialist Party campaign speeches, Debs constantly hammered on these truths. If the Democratic Party is the friend of labor any more than the Republican Party, he said in 1900, why is it its platform dumb in the presence of Coeur d'Alene? Debs was referring to an 1892 strike of Colorado miners where, after company guards killed five strikers, the miners marched the guards and strikebreakers out of town. The strike was broken when the governor sent in 1,500 troops and locked up 600 strikers in a stockade prison. Quote, what has the Democratic Party to say about the property and educational qualifications in North Carolina and Louisiana, and the proposed general disenfranchisement of the Negro race in the southern states? Asked Debs. The differences between the Republican and Democratic parties involved no issue, no principle in which the working class have any interest. End quote. The New Deal and civil rights eras are the touchstone today for those who argue that the Democrats lead a party of the people. In the 1930s, the Democrat Franklin Delano Roosevelt, warily eyeing the mass working class upsurge that led to the formation of the Congress of Industrial Unions, the CIO, presented himself as both a friend of labor and a savior of capitalism. Those who have property fail to realize, he wrote to Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, that I am the best friend the profit system ever had. During the course of the Civil Rights Movement, Southern Democrats deserted the party. Northern liberal Democrats were always one step behind the Civil Rights Movement, eager to wind down the struggle, which they feared, and win the voting allegiance of enfranchised blacks, which they coveted. The populist rhetoric of the Democrats is designed to take the fire out of any move to form a radical third party. Alarmed by the growth of the Populist Party, for example, which earned 1.4 million votes in the 1894 midterm elections, the Democratic Party fielded William Jennings Bryan as its presidential candidate in 1896. Bryan breathed populist rhetoric in order to win over Populist Party supporters. Democratic leaders also diligently cultivated the fusionist wing of the populists, which proposed merging the two parties. At its 1896 convention, the populists voted to endorse Bryan as their candidate. Populist leader Tom Watson knew this signaled the end of populism, writing, "Populists cannot denounce the sins of the two old parties and yet go into political co-partnership with them. The moment we make a treaty, the war must cease. And when we cease our war upon the two old parties, we have no longer any excuse for living." Watson warned, "Fusion means the Populist Party will play Jonah, and they, the Democrats, will play the whale." Watson was right. The decision to back Bryan effectively killed the Populist Party. The absence of any radical working class or left political parties is one of the secrets of the relative stability of bourgeois politics in the United States historically. Historically, narrowing at election time the choice, for workers and the poor, to one between two evils. The history of the two-party system shows that electing the lesser evil demobilizes mass struggle by putting the masses' faith in the actions of bourgeois politicians. It lowers the political level of the movement, too, because it compels activists to become apologists for a party that does not represent their interests. If the lesser evil wins, his, so far there have been no women presidents, policies in office are glaringly different from his campaign rhetoric. The most famous case of this was Lyndon Johnson, who won the presidential race in 1964 on a promise to end the war, but then sent 500,000 troops to Vietnam. This was a particularly egregious case because it turns out Johnson had secret plans to send more troops to Vietnam before he won the election. The two parties represent the liberal and conservative wings of the same capitalist class. What unites them, their commitment to serving the interests of capital, is far more important than their differences. That is why Clinton supported neoliberal free trade policies, just as Bush does now. That is why Clinton ended up pushing through Republican-style welfare reform that drastically slashed welfare for the poor. Marx and Engels had much to teach on the value of the left and progressives running their own candidates. In 1886, the Central Labor Union in New York formed the Independent Labor Party of New York and vicinity in order to participate in New York City's mayoral race. The new party chose single tax advocate Henry George as its candidate. George himself was not from the labor movement, but was a middle-class populist. He had recently written a popular book, Progress and Poverty, which advocated a single tax on landed property as a panacea to solve society's ills. In a hotly contested race in which the ruling class pulled out all the stops to prevent a Labor Party victory, George came in second in a three-way race with 31% of the vote. Writing from Europe, Engels was positive about the election. Quote, "In a country that has newly entered the movement, the first really crucial step is the formation by the workers of an independent political party, no matter how, so long as it is distinguishable as a labor party. that the first program of this party should still be muddle-headed and extremely inadequate, that it should have picked Henry George for its figurehead, are unavoidable, if merely transitory, evils. The masses must have time and opportunity to evolve, and they will not get that opportunity unless they have a movement of their own, no matter what its form, providing it is their own movement, in which they are impelled onwards by their own mistakes and learned by bitter experience. End quote. We must have a politically independent movement of our own, a lesson we still need to learn in the United States today. What about the oft-repeated argument that voting for left candidates steals votes from liberals and helps the right wing into power? According to this logic, there is no good time to break from the Democratic Party. The working class and the poor are doomed in perpetuity to vote for a party that does not really represent their interests. Every election time, we hear the argument that it is the, quote, most important election of our lifetime, and that the right can only be defeated by electing the lesser evil. The ultimate intention of all such phrases, wrote Marx, is to dupe the working class. If I tie a rope to the fender of a car sinking into a muddy lake, but the car pulls me into the muck instead, it is clear who is doing the pulling and who is being pulled. The repeated attempts by the left in America to capture or move the Democratic Party leftward follows this pattern. Misplaced support on the left for the Democratic Party has meant that our side is unable to use elections to count our forces. Worse, presidential elections disorient and disorganize our side. Liberals spend a great deal of time convincing activists to tone down the criticism, to refrain from struggle in the lead-up to the election, so as not to embarrass or undermine the Democratic candidate. Depending on the state of the class struggle, some more liberal Democrats may even offer verbal support for some of the demands of these social movements. But in the end, their purpose is to bring anyone leaning away from the Democrats back into the fold. On election day, they will be asked to vote for the more conservative Democratic candidate, who has been chosen for his or her, quote, electability. Dennis Kucinich ran a long-shot primary campaign in the 2004 presidential election that raised opposition to the occupation of Iraq and the Patriot Act, and support for universal health care. He ran not to win, but to corral leftists and progressives into the party. When it came time to choose the Democratic presidential candidate, he pressured all his supporters to vote for John Kerry, a pro-occupation, pro-Patriot Act, anti-universal health care centrist. The Democratic Party created third parties by running to the middle, explained Kucinich during his campaign. What I'm trying to do is to go back to the big tent so that everyone who felt alienated could come back through my candidacy. The practical result of not presenting a real left poll at election time is to permit a rightward drift of the general political climate in which both the liberal and conservative bourgeois candidates feel absolutely no pressure from the left. This politics of realism, or of the possible, therefore make the prospects for building an independent movement capable of achieving radical change even more remote. The logic of lesser evilism, both in the electoral sphere and in the realm of struggle, is always to narrow, constrict, and moderate demands, to accept anything so long as it is not the worst alternative. You can't fight the victory of the rightmost forces, argued Hal Draper, by sacrificing your own independent strength to support elements just the next step away from them. But that is precisely the argument made by liberals. Eugene Wagner, a Michigan attorney who served on the board of the National Coalition to abolish the death penalty, makes a typical argument. Death penalty opponents shouldn't support illegal civil disobedience protests, he insists, because it might drive away important affiliates, expose the organization to criminal proceedings, and give, quote, aid and comfort to many of our opponents spreading the false and pernicious idea that the abolition of the death penalty is based on radical left-wing principles, end quote. This is miles away from any idea that abolishing the death penalty is a struggle that must be taken to the streets, or that it is a class issue, part of the general attack on the poor and working class. On the contrary, many abolitionist lawyers believe that demonstrations actually hurt a prisoner's chance of finding justice. You'll anger the prosecutor or judge. The ultimate logic of this argument is that the best way to fight for reforms is to not fight at all. You'll lose anger, you'll anger those in power, and there will be a backlash. This was the message of the, quote, paper of record toward the immigrant rights protests that swept the country, culminating in boycotts, walkouts, and marches involving a few million people across the country in May 1st, 2006. Sleeping giants can and should get moving, the New York Times editorial graciously granted to a movement it had no power to stop. Quote, but they should tread carefully. The Times editors warned that the protests were a, quote, perilous business, suggesting instead of boycotts and strikes, delicate consensus building, to avoid antagonizing the immigrant-bashing right or sending students the wrong message about the importance of education. As if mass action to achieve social reform were not educational or effective. Liberals have a long history of preaching to mass movements to tread delicately so as not to provoke reaction. Naturally, there is no danger of backlash if the oppressed never fight back. To those who cautioned the civil rights movement to wait, Martin Luther King Jr. replied, "We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed." End of section.